ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci and Jason Lank in studio. As always, we are so glad to have you with us. We have a really nice show lined up today. There are several ETFs, as well as a few ETF filings in the hopper with the SEC, where the idea is to participate in the upside of the stock market, but avoid the bulk of a significant down move. There are also ETFs designed to just help mitigate a little bit of stock market risk, really serve as a smaller portfolio hedge. In just a moment, we'll be joined by ETF.com's Dave Nodig to take a look at some of these ETFs and ETF filings. Jason, I actually like how Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas likes to describe these. He calls them ETFs with airbags, right? If the market were to crash, you have some downside protection. Theoretically, you live to see another day. So in a 2008 type event, instead of being down, you know, 40, 50%, maybe you're only down a fraction of that. There are also ETFs that effectively just serve as portfolio insurance if the market were to plummet. There's no attempt to capture upside. These only pay off if the market tanks. Now, these strategies aren't necessarily new. Money managers have been running these for decades. But what is new is they're being packaged up into ETFs. And my sense is, as there's more talk about the bull market being a bit long in the tooth, these are going to attract some more attention.
I think this discussion, this is a very timely discussion, particularly, you're right, although it's been almost 10 years since the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, a lot of investors are still scarred from that. And we're all 10 years older now, and so risk management is on everybody's lips today. You know, when you think about it, the vast majority of investors up to this point have been long only or a form of buy and hold or something like that. Let's assume for an example that an investor has the traditional 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, maybe some satellite holdings sprinkled in, but the core being just kind of that basic generic portfolio. For these folks, there have been few ways to control risk other than just simply changing the allocation. If you wanted to be a little more aggressive, it's 70-30, a little less, take your foot off the gas pedal, maybe it's 50-50. But that's really all the choice you had, especially in, for example, 401ks, where there are very limited options. You know, I think up to this point, that's been one tool, but perhaps a blunt tool. Now with ETFs, the toolbox is so much bigger, and frankly, the tools are sharper. Investors can use a variety of strategies to massage returns or manage different kinds of risks that you mentioned. And this is in addition to or in place of just the standard allocation change. So this is going to be a great discussion.
All right. Now, also on the show today, we're going to cover what continues to be two very hot topics, Bitcoin and blockchain. And we have two tremendous guests for you. We'll first visit with Brian Kelly. He's a CNBC contributor. He's head of BKCM, which runs a cryptocurrency hedge fund. And he's also the portfolio manager for the recently launched REX BKCM ETF. This is one of the blockchain ETFs, and it is actively managed by Brian. We're going to discuss how he evaluates companies involved in cryptocurrencies and blockchain. We'll talk investment case, and we'll also hear his thoughts on potential Bitcoin ETFs, right, which certainly made a few headlines last week. Then later, we'll be joined by Eric Irvin, president and CEO of Reality Shares. He's going to spotlight the first ever China blockchain ETF, the Reality Shares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy China ETF. RealityShares also has a broader blockchain ETF. But, you know, we've said before that in lieu of a Bitcoin ETF being available, some investors view these blockchain ETFs as the next best thing. But, you know, there's a lot more potential in blockchain technology, I think, than just cryptos.
You're right. But to your point on Bitcoin, everybody and their brother has tried to file for a Bitcoin ETF, and we haven't seen one yet. Interestingly, just last week, the Winklevoss twins' attempt to bring one to market was ixnayed by the SEC. And remember, the Winklevoss twins were an early part of Facebook, so they've got, you know, cashed out with millions and millions years ago. So, but to your point about blockchain, while efforts to bring a Bitcoin ETF have stalled, at least for now, six blockchain ETFs have been launched this year. So this may fall into the category of next best thing. How close can we come to an actual Bitcoin ETF while not being an actual ETF? And I am looking forward to what Brian and Eric have to say on terms of blockchain and other applications beside cryptos. It's really important to remember that cryptos and the blockchain process are very interrelated, but they're not synonymous.
Yeah, these both should be tremendous conversations. As always, if you have questions or comments for us, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at Jason Lank. Let's start the show today with ETF.com's Dave Nodding.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com. The world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s.
For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets.
The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Dave, it does seem like there has been much more talk recently surrounding risk-managed ETFs, ETFs that can help protect investors from some market downside. Before we get into these, I'm just curious, do you think that's simply a product of the market environment we've been in, where maybe investors are beginning to wonder whether stocks might run out of steam?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look, just look at the performance of the S&P 500, take a time period, you know, year to date, we're up, what, 6-7%? You know, 1 year, we're at 15-16%. And I know that sometimes we don't all feel like things are going great because we focus on the story of the day, whether it's a Facebook collapse or whatever. But there's no way to look at the last couple of years' performance and not realize that we've actually had outsized core market performance. And I think that makes investors nervous, particularly when they look around at the political and the economic environment. It's hard to see how that lasts forever.
Well, let's walk through some of these risk-managed strategies. And I thought we might start with a recent filing from Amplify ETFs, because it seemed to generate quite a bit of buzz on social media. It's the Amplify Black Swan Growth and Treasury Core ETF, which will have a tremendous ticker symbol, by the way, SWAN. So this is couched as a way to protect investors from those tail events, Black Swan events. Have you had a chance to dig into this filing at all?
Yeah, sure. And I think this is one of several filings and several products we actually have in the market that really lean heavily into the derivatives markets to provide sort of interesting takes on equity exposure. So in this one case, the Swan ETF, it's going to take the majority of its money and put it in treasuries. So in other words, that core of the portfolio will be safe. And then 10% of the portfolio is going to invest in very long-dated options on the S&P 500 at prices below the prices we're at today. And the idea there is that if the market does keep going up, you'd expect the value of those options to go up as well. So you get some exposure to the move in the equity market. But because you're only putting that 10% of the market at risk, or that 10% of the fund at risk, you don't have any chance of sort of ending up 20, 30, 40% down in your portfolio or in that one fund, because 90% of the fund is invested in the treasury. So it creates an opportunity to get some of the exposure without taking all the risk. And I think that's the common theme with a lot of these products. How do I get some of the features of just pure equity exposure, but mitigate some of the risks of just, say, buying SPY?
Well, and on that note, you mentioned several filings in the hopper with the SEC. Innovator ETFs, I know one of the ETFs that they have is designed to provide the return of the S&P 500 up to a certain cap, but then you're protected from the first 10 or 15% drawdown in the market. Have you had a chance to look at those filings at all?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you know, what these funds are all doing is taking advantage of the fact that in the derivatives market, you can get people to take the other side of pretty specific bets. So here, you know, this is a classic kind of product you would put into a swap if you were a major institution, where you say I want the top, I want the 20% upside, but I'm willing to acknowledge I'm not going to get 21%, right? So if things go incredibly well next year, somebody else, i.e. the other part of the counter, the other counterparty in this transaction, is going to get the benefit of the big upside, you know, tail risk on the other side move. But the flip side of that is I'm using that to pay for downside protection. So, for instance, I only want to be exposed to a 10% drawdown. I don't want to have any chance of losing less than that. Those are actually, from a math perspective, fairly simple strategies to put on using options or using swap counterparties. They're just not something that most investors have had exposure to, because I think we're all a little nervous about wading into the derivatives markets, frankly, ever since the 80s, right? Ever since 87, I think we all have a little bit of skepticism about derivative strategies. But for the most part, these are tried and true risk reduction, risk management strategies coming from the institutional side of the house.
Now, we were talking SEC filings there, but in terms of existing ETFs, I believe the most popular risk managed strategies come from PACER ETFs, led by the PACER Trend Pilot U.S. Large Cap ETF, ticker symbol PTLC. This thing has around, $1.2 billion invested in it. I think PACER also has versions around mid-cap stocks, the NASDAQ, European stocks. But these all use a basic trend-following strategy to determine whether to be invested. What are your thoughts on that type of strategy?
Well, when we think about risk management strategies, they really do come into two flavors. The ones we were talking about previously are really derivatives and options-based ones, where you're using a product that already exists, like options, to manage that risk for you. The other type of products, like the PACER Trend Pilot products, are what I would call trigger products, in that they use some sort of mechanism to give the fund a signal to say, hey, take risk or don't take risk. In the case of something like PTLC, this is a tried and true strategy of just using the 200-day moving average, right? If the S&P is over its 200-day moving average for 5 days in a row, this fund is basically just buying SPY. It's just all in on the equity markets. When that 200-day moving average degrades, it either goes half to cash or effectively all to cash. And so this is a strategy advisors have been using for decades, this 200-day moving average strategy. This just puts it in a package. I think it's a perfectly legitimate approach. It hasn't worked all that well in recent markets. You know, when you have nothing but a long up market with the occasional hiccup, these strategies can be a little slow to react. And, of course, you're paying something for them. You know, that PACER product you're talking about charges over 60 basis points. Now, there's a billion dollars in assets that seems to want to use that strategy. The 60 basis points is a lot more than you can just buy S&P exposure for.
Well, and I think with any trend following strategy, if you get a little bit of volatility, you can also get that whipsaw where perhaps you're getting thrown in and out of positions.
Exactly at the wrong time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Going back to derivatives, what about covered call or put writing strategies where you can generate some premium by selling calls or puts? And of course, that premium can be used to help offset some negative performance from stocks. I believe PowerShares has the largest ETF in this space with their S&P 500 buy write ETF, PBP. That's a covered call strategy. WisdomTree has the SIBO S&P 500 put write strategy fund, PUTW. Do you like these as tools to help manage risk?
Sure, I suppose I have to caveat that Cboe Global Markets is my parent company, but that aside, you know, the put rate strategy is somewhat similar to what we were talking about in the Amplify filing, in that it fundamentally is going to sit on a bunch of cash or sit on a core set of positions and then write puts against them to generate income. In other words, it's using a feature of the derivatives markets to extract income. And, you know, that gives you sort of equity-light exposure, if you will, with an enhanced yield that you're getting from that premium that you generate. The flip side of that would be something like the Cambria Tail product, TAIL, which is effectively doing the opposite. That's just buying puts. That's just pure buying downside protection. In effect, it's sort of the opposite of that strategy. As you would expect, they perform completely differently. You know, TAIL, has frankly, you know, had a terrible one-year track record because the market's gone up, which is exactly what you would expect. Put W, you know, has done a nice job of sort of cranking out returns time after time after time with a good distribution yield, but you won't expect it to have the big swings of a pure equity exposure. So lots of flavors here. I think the challenge for investors is these can be pretty complicated strategies, and just because it says risk management on the label doesn't necessarily mean they're all trying to do the same thing or even go in the same direction, depending on which way the market goes.
Dave, this is Jason Lank. As risk management becomes the topic, you know, as the economic, we get a little longer in the tooth in this bull market, is there any possibility that some of these trades could get crowded? Are markets so deep and wide that the market can handle just about basically any need or any number of risk-managed ETFs?
Well, so certainly the ones that are either just using triggers, like going in and out of treasuries and S&P 500, obviously the capacity of the treasury and the S&P 500 to absorb strategies, I think, is effectively infinite. I mean, those are the most liquid markets in the world. And on the derivative side, I suppose on some of these strategies, the Amplify strategy that's looking deep out into the long-term options curve, some of those long-term options, some of those leaps can get a bit thin, but the most liquid ones are on big indexes like the S&P 500 or on the securities like SPY that track them. So I think there's probably a lot of capacity before you have to worry about that. And of course, the core options markets around big indexes like the S&P 500 are some of the most liquid markets in the world. The derivatives markets for the S&P 500 are bigger than the S&P 500 itself. These are truly some of the most liquid markets.
You mentioned that there are so many different flavors to risk management and that investors really need to go in with their eyes wide open. It seems to me there is not a seasonality, but from an economic cycle standpoint, that would have to be something that people take into account. For this is just me talking out loud, but for example, a put right strategy makes a lot of sense to me in March of 2009. It makes a lot less sense to me in August of 2018, just based on where market valuations are. Is there any sense to that?
Yeah, absolutely. There are no strategies that work perfectly in every market. And I think, once you're outside the most boring long-term 20-year asset allocation portfolio, you're always going to have an opinion on the business cycle. You're always going to have an opinion somewhere. I think the only exceptions to those would be, as you pointed out in the opening segment, the sort of airbag strategies that really buffer both ends of your performance spectrum. And those are the defined outcome type products that we've seen these filings from Innovator around. Those really are designed to provide you some buffers on both the up and downside, so you really have a clear understanding of where the edges of your experience are going to be. I think those are genuinely unique products. I'm excited to have those come to market. Most of the other products we have in the market are much more tactical in the sense that you do have to have some sense of where you believe the market's going to know whether or not it's the right time to be in them.
Dave, we have about 2 minutes left, and on that note, understanding when you want to utilize these products, and you mentioned earlier, of course, understanding the products just in general, always know what you own. But something that strikes me about really all of these ETFs is they're all rules-based, right? So theoretically, that removes human emotion from the equation, at least at the product level. But at the investor level, all of these are going to have stretches of either underperformance or maybe just no performance at all. Now, I'm always a fan of more ETF innovation, but do you have any concerns that investors won't be able to stick with these strategies?
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern. I think it's less a concern for the sort of airbag strategies, which really are designed to be sort of long-term buy and hold type strategies. But something like Tail, the Cambria strategy that's effectively just buying puts, that is intentionally a tactical tool. That is a tool. That is an investment that somebody would use because they really want to buy downside protection right now for some period of time, and they're not comfortable, for instance, going out and just buying those puts themselves. And so, with those types of strategies, not only may not investors stick to them, maybe they shouldn't, right? They may, in fact, be tactical tools by design.
Well, Dave, with that, we'll have to leave it there. As always, thanks for joining us. We'll chat again next week.
Thanks for having me. See you next week.
That was ETF.com's Dave Nottig. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by BKCM's Brian Kelly. We'll talk cryptocurrencies and blockchain, including the REX BKCM ETF. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci and Jason Link in studio. We are now very pleased to be joined by Brian Kelly, head of BKCM. They run a cryptocurrency hedge fund. Brian is also a regular contributor on CNBC. He's authored a book on Bitcoin titled The Bitcoin Big Bang. And he has over 25 years of experience in equity trading and portfolio management. But Brian is the portfolio manager for the recently launched REX BKCM ETF, ticker symbol BKC. This is one of the new blockchain ETFs, and it's what we'll be focusing on here today. Brian is joining us via phone from New York. Brian, a pleasure having you on the program today.
Yeah, great to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
Brian, first, maybe give us a little background here. How did you first become interested in cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, and when was that?
Yeah, sure. So my background is as a global macro investor. So my specialty is in currencies, fixed income, commodities, but really currencies are what I focused on. So in 2012, I stumbled across Bitcoin. I think I read about it. It might have been in the Financial Times or something like that. I read an article and pretty much summarily dismissed it, thinking that, you know, this is a scam. It's not going to work. How could this be a real currency? It's this digital currency of some kind. I can't touch it. Doesn't have an army. You can't pay taxes with it. All the things of why this couldn't work, I had in my head. In 2013, as the price started to go up, I started to pay a little more attention to it. And then I did a deep dive for about a year. And really kind of went into what the technology is, trying to understand why this is important. And then I had my aha moment. And the aha moment was when I realized that ultimately cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology are simply just software that allows us to remove the middleman from a lot of financial services. And once I realized that, I understood, you know what, this is going to change everything about my business. This is going to change everything about the way I do business. And it's an emerging technology that I want to be involved in. So I wrote a book in 2014 called The Bitcoin Big Bang, and since then have been an investor in the space on both the equity side and the cryptocurrency side.
All right, so before we get to the ETF, let's quickly touch on a few of the basics surrounding blockchain technology. How do you describe blockchain to the layperson?
Real simply, blockchain itself is a database, and all it is a way to store data securely. Now, what we're using it for is to store the value of a currency securely, but that's really all it is. And the way that it works is simply every 10 minutes, all the transactions that happen between you and I are gathered up into a block. That block is then broadcast out to all the miners, which are the computers that run the software, and then they verify and process the transaction, just like a typical bank might do. And that's called a block. That block is then linked to the previous block that happened 10 minutes ago, and you have a blockchain. Where the cryptocurrency comes in is the cryptocurrency is the economic incentive to run the software that is the entire system. So pretty simply, it's a database with an economic incentive attached to it.
Now, my sense is many investors are familiar with blockchain primarily because of cryptocurrencies or crypto assets, things like Bitcoin. But of course, there are many other potential use cases for blockchain technology. Can you maybe walk us through an example or two of those other use cases?
Sure. Any place that you have a trusted third party or a middleman involved is probably a place where you could use blockchain and cryptocurrency. So besides the currency part, something like title insurance or just titles in general, real estate titles. You know, the process now is somebody has to go back and do the title search and look for every person that ever owned the particular property and then verify they owned it. And then once you want to sell your house, that title then gets transferred to you. Using blockchain technology, the ownership of the property is recorded in the blockchain always. And so all you have to do simply is say, yeah, you know what? My house has been recorded in the blockchain. The title, you can see the ownership all the way back from the day the house was built up to today. We can verify it. Great. Sold my house. Let's move on. And you don't have to have all the lawyers, all the title insurance people, everything involved in a real estate transaction.
Our guest is Brian Kelly, head of BKCM. Brian, let's talk about the ETF, the REX BKCM ETF. Again, ticker symbol BKC. This is actively managed by you. Tell us about your investment process, what the ETF holds, and what the overall investment goal is here.
Sure. So let's start with the overall investment goal. What we're trying to give people is exposure to blockchain and cryptocurrency ecosystem. And so what I think about this portfolio is the picks and shovels play on the space. We have a new technology, very similar to how the internet was a new technology in the early 90s. This is a new technology for this generation, in my view. And so what we're trying to do is we have a portfolio of global equities, that are generating revenue and or devoting material resources to blockchain and cryptocurrency. What we'll do is we are weighted about 45% towards Asia. We are weighted to the small and mid-cap sector, and primarily that's because that's where most of these companies are residing right now. Asia adoption is very big. Small and mid-cap are where we're getting the purest plays on the space. So that's kind of the big picture of what we think about the portfolio. Drilling down a bit, we have four pillars that we invest in, four themes. Number one is Wall Street disruptors, and that's anybody using blockchain to change the way that we trade securities. Number two are the mining and exchanges, anybody who's providing that on-ramp so people can use this, the cryptocurrency exchanges, the cryptocurrency miners, or even the banks that are servicing those cryptocurrencies, exchanges, and miners. Then we have enterprise blockchain, that's our third pillar. That's anybody who's using blockchain technology to streamline a business process. So IBM's a good example for that one. And then the last one is decentralized internet builders or Web3. These are anybody who's using this blockchain technology to change the way that we use the web. And the example there is, you know, what we found with Google and Facebook, they have an awful lot of our data. And they're able to make billions and billions of dollars a year off of our data. Web3 is going to be a decentralized internet where you, the user, control your data and you, the user, get paid for your data. And so we're looking for companies that are building that or devoting material resources towards that.
Brian, I mentioned this is an actively managed ETF. Why do you think active management is important in this space? Because there are some other ETFs that have taken an index-based approach.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's interesting. There's a concept called Bitcoin time that we joke about in the industry, but it just means that everything is sped up. And so this, because we're on the cutting edge of technology, every week there's some new information. Every day there's new information. And what was popular last week and last month may not necessarily be popular or even viable this week. So for me, this entire sector and industry is ripe for active management. If you look back at the history of tech, you know, it changed a lot. MySpace existed well before Facebook, right? So what I want to be able to do is to adapt and adjust to the rapidly changing landscape, and that's where active management comes into play.
Brian, this is Jason Lank. A portion of the blockchain ecosystem that fascinates me are the miners. And I read a lot about the blockchain, but you know, who are these miners? Not much is written about them. Are these giant corporations just operating with data centers? Are these individuals, you know, a couple of teenagers stringing together a few Xboxes? Give some high-level color on who the miners are, and if I want to be a miner, how do I become a miner?
So, yeah, sure. So it did start with, essentially teenagers and gamers and computer enthusiasts that were stringing a couple computers together and mining. In terms of Bitcoin mining, it has become a enterprise, a big corporation type of thing, where you have these massive data centers located throughout the world. China's big, Canada's big, Washington State in the U.S. is big because the electricity costs are very low. But effectively, all they're doing is putting computers together that are running the software, the Bitcoin software. And all they do is they act very similar to how a bank acts. They just do it with a computer. And they just do it automated. They verify that, yep, you know what, Brian Kelly owned this Bitcoin, and I'm going to send it to Mary Smith. And they verify that I owned it, it's not counterfeit, and they process the transaction. That's what the miners do. So right now you see there's probably three or four major global corporations that are miners on Bitcoin. If you want to mine at home, there's ways to do it. There are other coins that you might be able to do. There are a couple websites, and the names escape me now, that'll tell you which coins are profitable line with your home computer. So certainly the home gamer can get into it.
Brian, going back to the blockchain ETFs, I'm sure you've seen some of the criticisms surrounding them, that they're basically just semiconductor or financial services plays. How do you respond to that?
First of all, this is financial technology. It's fintech. So there's going to be an element of that. I also think, when I look at our portfolio, I'm very conscious that we are not simply just replicating XLF and XLK, which are the financial and technology ETFs. What my team does, we have boots on the ground throughout the world. In fact, my head of research just got back from Korea yesterday. He was there for 2 weeks. And we're really digging through all these companies, trying to find the companies that are really at the heart of this ecosystem. And then, what we'll do as an active manager is we're going to overweight the pure plays. We're going to overweight the companies that are getting most of their revenue or a significant portion of their revenue from this. Now, if you say, well, I'm just going to do the financial and technology ETFs, what you're really getting there is exposure to something very different than blockchain. Most of that revenue is coming from, whether they be gaming chips or AI chips or in the financial sector, they're coming from traditional financial systems. You look at what we have in the portfolio, the financials that we have in there are banks that specifically are servicing cryptocurrency exchanges and funds. And they're growing their asset base significantly, which will have an impact on their revenue more than something that maybe, a Bank of America or a Citigroup, you're not even going to move the needle there. So that's what we're really focused on.
On that note of companies' exposure to blockchain, earlier you touched on some of the other uses for blockchain outside of cryptos. But how much do you think the real upside of companies involved in blockchain is ultimately dependent upon cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin really catching on mainstream? How tied at the hip are these?
Well, you can think of the price of cryptocurrencies as somewhat of a barometer of acceptance. So there is some connection that, if Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are used a lot, then the value of the currency should grow to support that ecosystem. So, you as a quick kind of look, you can say, hey, yeah, this is one way to look at acceptance. But on the other side of it, there's cost savings that can happen. So I'll give you an example. IBM has been working with Walmart in China to use blockchain technology to track pork from the farms all the way to the Walmart stores. And what they found is they're able to significantly reduce spoilage. They're also able to track any foodborne diseases quicker than they could. So Walmart's saving a lot of money by using it. So it may not necessarily show up on the price of Bitcoin. It may not show up on the revenue line in Walmart, but it'll certainly show up on the savings that they're getting.
All right, Brian, we have just a couple of minutes left here. Before we let you go, I have to ask you about the potential for a Bitcoin ETF. So last week we saw the SEC shoot down another Bitcoin ETF filing. There's, of course, been a lot of back and forth between ETF providers and the SEC. It seems like there are still some fairly significant hurdles to overcome. What are your thoughts on a Bitcoin ETF? And do you think the SEC is right to play it cautious here?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the SEC has been very thoughtful about their regulation of this industry. And so I would applaud them, number one, on that. I think the blockchain cryptocurrency community still has a couple hurdles that we have to get through. The SEC has said, number one, they would like to see a U.S.-based regulated exchange for cryptocurrencies. We don't quite have that yet. We're moving in that direction. Number two, and this would be part of that exchange likely or some solution, is a custody solution. Right now, a lot of these assets are self-custody. But I think probably by the end of this year, we'll probably have a custody solution that the SEC will be comfortable with. So my view is Bitcoin ETF in 2018, I think is a low probability, but I certainly think 2019 it's a very high probability.
Well, Brian, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Really appreciate you having me.
That was Brian Kelly, head of BKCM. Again, the ETF is the REX BKCM ETF. And you can learn more about this ETF by visiting rexshares.com. That's rexshares.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll look at another blockchain ETF, the RealityShares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy China ETF. We'll be joined by RealityShares President and CEO Eric Irvin. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime, Nate and Jason in studio. Now it's time for our ETF Spotlight.
It's time for the ETF Spotlight, where each week we highlight one exchange-traded fund. There are thousands of ETFs available to invest in. ETF Prime has sorted through them all, so you don't have to.
The ETF we're spotlighting this week is the RealityShares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy China ETF, ticker symbol BCNA. This is the first China-focused blockchain ETF on the market. And joining us via phone from San Diego to discuss this ETF is Eric Irvin, President and CEO of RealityShares. Eric, great having you back on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Eric, let's just jump right in here. First, why focus solely on companies in China?
Yeah, well, I think one thing that most people ignore is just that China is this just emerging market, but China is all in on blockchain. First of all, it's the second largest stock market in the world, and I think a lot of people overlook that. It's over $8.5 trillion stock market. But as far as blockchain goes, there are over three times as many patents in based on Chinese companies than U.S. companies. The U.S. or the Chinese government has made it part of their five-year economic plan. The president of China has even said this could be 10 times bigger than the internet. So they don't want to see like the what happened with the internet, where the U.S. really dominated in internet innovation. They don't want to see that happen, and so they are just all in on blockchain.
All right, so walk us through the ETF. How are holdings determined? How are they weighted? How many holdings? Give us the details here.
Sure. So as you know, we came out with our global blockchain ETF back in January, and this is going to use that same scoring system where we take all of the companies now in just China alone, so mainland China companies, both the ETFs as well as A shares and H shares, and we can get into a little bit of that later. But and then we score them in seven different categories, from number of patents to number of filings to what is their economic impact going to be if they are wildly successful in blockchain. You know, some of these are very large companies, and they just have a smattering of blockchain-related initiatives. And then we rank that, and then we use a blockchain advisory board, so these industry experts to weigh in on each of those different scores. And then we come up with the top blockchain-related companies. And then those are the ones that make it into the fund. Right now, there's about 30 companies in the fund right as we speak.
Can you talk a little bit more about that scoring process in terms of exactly what goes into it?
Sure. So as I mentioned, so patents. So how many patents has the company filed? And as I was mentioning earlier, China has almost three times as many patents as U.S. companies do in terms of blockchain-related technology. They were really early innovators in the blockchain space. But we look at how many patents has the company filed. Did they just, you know, what this is doing is it's filtering out the companies that just essentially changed their name to blockchain.com or something like that in order to get the PR hype but not really engaged in the business. The next thing is public filings. So how many, we scan through all of their annual filings, their quarterly filings, press releases, everything, and look for mentions of the term blockchain. What are they doing in their business? Is it a revenue generator or is it just a cost reducer? Because as you know, blockchain can take out a lot of friction from a company's business. And so both of those things can impact the businesses itself. And that lends itself to another factor, which is this economic impact. So if this company is wildly successful with blockchain and their initiatives, and blockchain is as big as we think it can be, how much is it going to impact the stock price? Which is, you know, critical for those people who are really looking to get that pure play exposure. And then we look at, are they a member of any of the industry consortium? There's a number of consortium available right now that these companies can be members of. And how actively engaged are they in that consortium? Are they developing software and open source software? Are they advising businesses on how to use that software? And so we're working with these blockchain industry experts to help us kind of guide their use of blockchain in the business. And then finally is, what are they doing with blockchain? So are they a user of the technology, such as, to use an American company, Walmart? So Walmart's using blockchain in order to identify supply chain inefficiencies. Or are they actually consulting and building out revenue systems like IBM, where they're developing blockchain solutions for companies like Walmart in order to generate revenues? And then we just, of course, apply those scores and then add them up to a final blockchain score. And we keep all these scores on investinthechain.com. If anybody wanted to look at individual companies, they could see how each company is scored in that blockchain score.
All right. So as I look at the holdings in this ETF, there are some very familiar names, Alibaba, Baidu, Tencent. Can you maybe highlight some of the blockchain-related activities these companies are involved in?
Yeah. So, again, you know, these are big, big businesses, but there's a reason that they're so big. It's because they're so innovative in their field, and they're constantly trying to figure out ways to use new technologies to make their business better. So Alibaba, they're working with Australia and New Zealand companies right now to introduce blockchain-based food tracking systems. So when you think about blockchain, really what it is, it's this distributed ledger. And so if everyone has access to the same ledger, then we can identify when something transferred from one, you know, party to the next, to the next, to the next, and we can track things nowadays with GPS and Internet of Things kind of sensors. We can know the temperature that a food item was, so we can identify spoilage opportunities, but we can also, with smart contracts, make payments, so it doesn't have to go to some back office and have, you know, somebody send out an invoice and then somebody receive the invoice and then argue about it. It's all immediate because it's all done on a blockchain solution. So that's where Alibaba's working. In fact, a lot of these Chinese companies, because they're so heavy in kind of that manufacturing and supply chain piece of it, they're building out these blockchain-related supply chain solutions that not only they can use, but also the world can use. And that's an opportunity for them to both reduce cost, but also add revenue. JD.com is another one that's in the fund. Google just recently invested almost $500 million into JD, which is a publicly traded company. You don't see that very often. And it was purely because Google wanted their supply chain technology and expertise, and JD has been using blockchain in their supply chain initiatives going back almost 7 years. So it's really exciting to see that. And then from Tencent is a, you know, kind of a social media software services business, and they're using it in order to really kind of prevent a lot of the things that happen with Facebook, where, you know, identity and privacy can all be done in terms of blockchain, and you can control what data is out there. So you can own your data instead of, say, a Facebook or some other centralized party owning your data and then just monetizing it. So you could have actually potentially earn revenues and have advertisers pay you to watch their advertisements instead of paying an intermediary like before.
We're visiting with Eric Irvin, President and CEO of Reality Shares. We're spotlighting the Reality Shares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy China ETF, ticker symbol BCNA. Eric, let's talk overall investment case. So if you were to boil this down, what do you see as the longer term potential for blockchain technology as a whole, and then in China in particular?
I think of it really like early days of the Internet. You know, when I graduated and kind of saw the Internet for the first time, it was a very clunky. It was back in the mid-90s. It was hard to use. There was no web browsers. There was no, you know, it was really just a difficult thing to understand the potential behind it. But you knew there was something there. That's a little bit like where we are today with blockchain. So it's clunky. It's hard to use. The on-ramps and off-ramps haven't been developed yet. The first kind of killer app of the Internet was email. That was where it really became apparent to all of us the power of the Internet. The first killer app of blockchain was Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. But it's so much bigger than just cryptocurrencies themselves. It's really all of the ability to take friction out of kind of networks and interdependent processes. So in that regard, it could be as transformative as the internet was, because it's really like the internet of assets now, whereas before we had the internet of information. So to that end, it's going to impact almost every sector of the economy, but it's going to take time. So how do you invest? Well, you got to figure out a way to invest in the companies that are innovating. So I kind of think of it as buy the innovators and dump the dogs. So if you're not innovating and if you're not adopting and embracing blockchain technology in your business, you're probably a company that I don't want to own. So investing in companies that are innovating in the space. And then from a blockchain perspective, it's pretty diverse. So you can have a fairly diverse portfolio. It'll be mostly weighted towards financials and technology right now. But eventually it will broaden out towards manufacturing, just like the internet did. Really, the internet impacted every business. And then just why China? So, you know, China is a massively underinvested market. If you look at all of the ETF assets that are dedicated to China alone, it pales in comparison to the global market cap of China. And then if you look at the ones that are focused on just Chinese A shares, it's a drop in the bucket. Literally, it's like $20 billion of assets dedicated just to Chinese A shares alone. And compared to the rest of the ETF business, it's massively underinvested. So you have to be there. Even Goldman Sachs was saying it from before, it was kind of a nice to have. Now it's a must have access to your allocation. And again, it's just not easy to get to. So that was why we wanted to build out a Chinese only ETF, BCNA, to really capture those blockchain and the China initiatives all in one comprehensive package.
Eric, we have just a few minutes left here. As you mentioned earlier, you did launch the Reality Shares NASDAQ Next Gen Economy ETF, BLCN, earlier this year. This is a much broader blockchain ETF. I think it currently has around $120 million invested in it. I'm just curious, is there any overlap between BCNA and BLCN?
Yeah, there is. And the reason we actually launched, typically when an ETF issuer or any asset manager launches a global product, most of the time it will ignore the mainland A shares. They've only recently been kind of opened up so that investors could get exposure, but it's not easy and it's not direct. And so there's just a lack of investment in Chinese A shares. But in this case, we had ADRs, and we had ADRs are basically Chinese companies that trade on U.S. exchanges. And then we had H shares. H shares are the shares that trade in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. But we did not have the A shares. So there's about 8 companies in the global portfolio, blockchain, BLCN, that are Chinese companies, but they're just traded on the H share market in Hong Kong as well as U.S. In the blockchain China ETF, there's about 30 companies total, 31, and 8 of them are also ADRs and H shares, which has an overlap. So if you combine the two portfolios together, you'd end up with around 90 companies, so a global portfolio with China mainland as well as those companies that trade on the ADR market as well as the H shares.
All right, Eric, 2 minutes left. I have to ask you this question, same question I asked Brian Kelly earlier. What are your thoughts on the prospects for a Bitcoin ETF? And how do you think this ultimately plays out with the SEC?
I think it's inevitable. It's not going to happen next week, that's for sure. If we do see one, I think it'll probably be at least towards the end of this year, if not maybe towards the end of next year. But I do think that's coming. The SEC was pretty clear the other day with Hester Pierce. She came out, and she's one of the SEC commissioners, and I'm not sure if Brian was able to discuss this, but her dissent was a very public dissent, and she talked about why she disagreed with the SEC's decision to not approve the Bitcoin ETF. And really her point was it's not our job to discuss the merits of an investment. It's our job to make sure that investments are properly disclosed and that there's no impact on insider trading or manipulation in markets. That's the SEC's job. It's to govern the investment world. It's not to make sure that people have good investments or bad investments. That's up to people to decide, because the government isn't really there for that. And that, in her opinion, the SEC overstepped their bounds. So I think you'll start to see a lot more talk around this, and eventually the SEC will, you know, kind of wake up to the fact that, it's not their job to prevent products from hitting the market. It's just their job to prevent, you know, unlawful activities and inadequate disclosures. And that's really their job, to protect people, is just to make sure that investments are properly disclosed and that there's, you know, no manipulation or insider information that's happening.
Well, Eric, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Congratulations on the launch of BCNA and certainly the success you've seen so far with BLCN. As always, we appreciate you joining us on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Eric Irvin, President and CEO of Reality Shares. And you can learn more about both of their blockchain ETFs by visiting realityshares.com. What's interesting to me about this, these blockchain ETFs, is they have received quite a bit of criticisms just because the holdings are a little bit broader, sort of like we discussed with Brian Kelly earlier. But Eric hit on something there that I think is correct, in that it's like the early days of the internet. And I feel like the sense out there among the investing public is there is something there, and people can feel it, but it's not maybe as tangible as you want it to be right now. And so I just think this is an interesting space, because I can see the criticisms on the blockchain ETFs, but I also see the other side of the equation where you do feel like there's something there.
This does feel like the early days of the internet. And if you think about, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you didn't know who the winners and losers were going to be. Very hard to take a rifle shot. It was probably much better to take a shotgun approach and try to pick up some of the players that would do well. But no question that this could be potentially a terrific satellite holding for investors.
All right. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, and also on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at Jason Lank. Next week, we have two excellent guests for you. We'll first be joined by Toby Lofton, Managing Principal at BP Capital Fund Advisors. He's going to walk us through the NYSE Pickens Oil Response ETF. This is the ETF that billionaire T. Boone Pickens has put his name behind. And then Matt Bielski, CEO of Defiance ETFs, will spotlight an ETF launching tomorrow, the Defiance Future Tech ETF. Until then, have a great week, everyone.